KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers, offering a new 2025 lineup of vehicles at your local Toyota dealer, including a new Tacoma with turbocharged four-cylinder engines and a hybrid powertrain option. The San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.
You are listening to Port of Entry. If you tuned into our last episode, we spoke to three young and rising female filmmakers from the Borderlands whose work debuted in the Cannes Film Festival last year and touched on the challenges about being a woman filmmaker in this region of the world.
Today's episode is in that vein.
¿Qué onda, Pao? Come. Gracias, gracias.
That is Paulina Castro, known artistically as Paulina Casmur, a 17-time Emmy Award-winning TV producer and creative director from Tijuana.
And old friend and mentor of our producer, Julio.
Julio's sensei, in a sense.
Julio and Alan met with her that day, and Julio couldn't help but to put Alan on the spot, because Alan made a rare stage appearance for that morning's field taping.
Hey man, I need my beauty sleep. Just kidding, you guys know I work in the mornings. Long work day, and you lucked out that I started my day at 1 in San Diego that day.
Alan, Paulina, Alan es el conductor del programa.
After introducing myself to Paulina and vice versa, Paulina escorted us into her mother's home where she was visiting.
Paulina works and lives in Denver, where she leads the creative department of a Spanish language TV station. Her professional career has primarily revolved around the news beat.
¿Es futbolero o no es futbolero el Chapulín Colorado?
Futbolero.
And she's also a seasoned documentary filmmaker, currently looking to break into the fiction market.
Estamos tratando de encontrar a Cristian de Jesús Terrazas López. Es un muchacho de 21 años de edad.
Del río Tijuana y tiene una trascendencia muy importante también por el...
No lo voy a entender nunca. Son tan volubles como el clima de Tijuana.
Her perspective on filmmaking has brought a unique lens into news production, and it's paid off. She's won 17 Emmys in the news production field.
And the Emmy goes to Photographer News, Armadillos, Búsqueda y Rescate, Parte 1, Paulina Castro, KBNT. La Casa Whaley, Paulina Castro, KBNT. Brown Bag Coalition, Paulina Castro.
Univision San Diego, Paulina Castro, KBNT.
Hey, Dad, I'm not giving you grandkids, but I'm giving you Emmys, which is better.
Paulina is one of those individuals who can light up a room with her infectious laughter and inspire a team to rally behind her ideas and vision even in the fast-paced environment of a newsroom.
Her 17 Emmy Awards are a testament to that.
She was in town visiting friends and family, and we couldn't let the opportunity pass to sit down and talk to one of the region's most decorated TV producers.
In today's episode, we sit down with Paulina as she reflects on 20 years of producing TV and documentaries. We talk about making it as a woman and borderlander in this competitive field, as well as the challenges of covering border stories.
And creating a category for border issues in the Emmys.
If this is your first time tuning in, we're speaking with shapers and visionaries of the borderlands.
You are listening to Fronterizas Behind the Camera. Stay tuned.
From KPBS, this is Port of Entry,
where we tell cross-border stories that connect us.
I'm Alan Lilienthal.
And I'm Natalie Gonzalez.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalich, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
You are listening to Port of Entry.
As we entered Paulina's mother's house, the place where Paulina grew up, we were welcomed by a stunning view from its location, in the hills of the Gabilondo community, overlooking the city of Tijuana.
Her mother greeted Alan and Julio at the entrance.
Señora, ¿se acuerda de mí? ¿Cómo está?
The interior of the house had warm blue-gray colors, typical of a modern household, with a beautiful living room and dining area adorned by perfectly framed art posters.
These artworks were complemented by vibrant depictions of Mexican culture, including colorful alebrijes, among other Mexican art pieces, adding a touch of traditional Mexican charm.
Perfecto. No manches.
Paulina surprised Julio with a picture from a newspaper page from their early college days. Julio was featured as one of 20 students who received a college-wide recognition. He was sporting the distinguished Kelso bob.
That's
me. Eras muy inteligente, Julio. No sé qué pasa.
Todavía, todavía. Ya se le quemó.
Mira, pero yo sé que sí, siempre ha sido.
Ah, sí, student of distinction.
What can I say? I was a student of difference.
Not much to show for it these days.
Ándale, pues.
Anyway, Paulina pulled out some old memorabilia like flyers from some of her screenings, along with old newspaper cutouts of reviews of her documentaries. One of them was for a project where she documented the lives of circus artists.
Este era cortometraje, corto documental de cómo viven los artistas en el circo.
Another piece of memorabilia was of a documentary that Paulina and Julio put together for a 100-hour rally competition around 12 years ago.
Esa es la constancia del documental que hice contigo.
No mames, güey.
Entonces, esto fue un documental que hicimos en 100 horas, Julio y yo. Y ganamos.
¿Cómo que 100 horas?
Nos pusieron en un hotel y órale, graben y editen. Menos, eran 100 horas, ¿no?
Como 90, en 3 días.
Paulina shared that for that competition, each team was tasked with recording in the field and then post-producing from a dingy motel room where the rally staff was supervising to make sure they weren't getting any outside help. This all had to be done under 100 hours.
We actually took first place, and the competition was fierce. That's the project that made me fall in love with storytelling.
And the project that tested Paulina's patience.
Paulina understands us.
Sí, aguantándonos. Wow, este güey pegaba cosas en la pared y yo, no mames, déjalo, o sea, abrir, bien libre.
El hecho de que era pedante, güey, it's a trait, dude.
Our attention was then drawn to a little Emmy statue over a piano surrounded by family pictures.
Sí, ese es el único Emmy que está aquí, porque todos están en mi casa y otros en casa de mi papá. Déjame ver. Aquí, pues, es lo único que hay ahí, está la foto de... Ahí está la foto de cuando fui a la primera ceremonia que no gané. ¡Tarán!
She handed us a picture of her holding her very first Emmy statue, along with the statue.
Alan held up the statue, savoring the glory of winning. Vicariously, though, via Paulina's merits.
Hey, a man can dream.
Esto era como trabajar en Univision, un programa de noticias.
Ese es el que más estás orgulloso, ¿sabes? ¿Por qué lo tienes hasta aquí?
No, porque le quise dejar uno a mi mamá y uno a mi papá cuando antes de irme a Colorado.
Paulina has been nominated 35 times and won 17 of those nominations. She's virtually batting 500.
Paulina mentions she gifted one statue to her mother and another one to her dad before moving to Colorado.
That one at her mother's house read, Pacific Southwest chapter of Emmy's outstanding news promo. She won it for a promo campaign she put together when she was working for a local Spanish-speaking TV station in San Diego.
Y mañana la ceremonia.
¿Y por qué estás ahí?
Porque ahorita estoy trabajando en Colorado.
Ah,
ajá.
Entonces aquí no vas de paseo.
Sí, mañana me regreso.
Ah.
O sea, mañana llegando me voy a la gala.
Julio,
cambio y me voy.
Julio no me dio mucha información.
¿No?
Puse el chat, pero ahí andabas en serio.
Ahí andabas con las groupies, Alan.
Curiously enough, she was scheduled to fly back to her home in Denver.
The day after we interviewed her.
To make the 2025 Emmy ceremony for the Pacific Mountain chapter.
The Emmy region she now belongs to. As Paulina was entertaining us, Paulina's mother was behind the kitchen counter preparing a delightful Mexican breakfast spread, which silently thrilled our producer Julio, though he tried to maintain his composure.
As you may expect, he loved this warm reception.
Sure did.
What did she prepare, Julio?
Oh, man. I mean, her mom got some of that chicharrón pork belly that you see going viral. You know, the one that looks like a baby arm that people stick into a cup of guacamole? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, that sounds good.
Some of that charred nopalito salad, refried frijolitos, and some fresh tortillas. All with three different types of salsas. Green, matcha, and habanero.
Y de seguro te atragantaste, como siempre.
I did not stuff myself. This time.
Qué mentiroso. After a bit of coffee, we jumped right into the interview.
Hey, welcome to Port of Entry. Welcome to the show, Paulina.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Absolutely, good morning. Coffee's great. Vibes are good. Vibes are high. Julio looks good.
Cloudy day in Tijuana.
Cloudy day in Tijuana. Okay, you ready to start?
Yeah.
Cool.
Let's do it.
Well, tell us a little bit about your upbringing. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in San Diego, raised in Tijuana. We are in the neighborhood where I grew up. And I went to the community college in Chula Vista. So I was crossing the border every day to go to school. And then eventually I transferred to UC Santa Cruz. But the border has been part of my life. And yeah.
So you've been crossing the border since you were pretty much born.
Since I was born, and every day when I went to college or community college, and it's been part of, even like after when I was working, that was one of the reasons why I decided to move, because crossing the border for me was like a lot after the pandemic.
Do you have Sentry?
Yeah, I do. But like just the thought of investing all that energy, going back and forth, especially back to Mexico, it was a lot.
So, yeah, it can be. It can be very draining sometimes.
Yeah, and you know how hard it is to live in San Diego if you don't have like the best income. So Tijuana is always the first option.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any early memories of crossing the border that stick out?
Yeah, I remember trying to be a rebel and fighting the border patrols all the time, not wanting to put my, you know, my school bag in the machines they had. And if they were mean to someone, I would be like defending them because I was like, yeah, I'm a U.S. citizen. What are you going to do with me? Like,
because you had the power, you know, they couldn't really do it much.
That's what I thought. Of course, they will be pissed at me and be like, go to secondary inspection, you know, and I'm like, whatever. So, yeah, and even later when I had the sentry, if they were rude, I would be like, no, I don't think you're right. And he's like, I'm going to send you to secondary inspection so someone else tells you that I'm right.
Did those experiences have anything to do with you starting to make movies?
I don't know. I just feel like maybe not just movies, but just like the way I am, that I feel that I always want to be a rebel against some things when I don't feel that they are or think that they are fair. Mm. And still to like now that I'm working in a bigger corporation, I feel like it's really hard for me because in my nature is fighting against things that I don't think are fair.
Mm. When did you start making movies?
So the first short film I made was when I was like maybe 17, and I was at the community college Southwestern. But I had a video camera since I was 12. So I have a lot of video recordings when I was like very, very young. It's really hard now to like be able to see what they have, mm-hmm. but I have them. Like I never threw them in the trash. Mm.
So when you were 17 is when you properly started making.
Yeah, that's when
putting them together.
It was more formal. It was after reading the Doors biography and knowing that Jim Morrison went to film school at UCLA, and that I thought like, wow, I've been having this camera for so long, and I love making short videos because we didn't have a phone, like we didn't have that. It was like authentic. Like I really liked that, mm-hmm. and I thought like, well, maybe I can go to school for that. So that's how it started.
What was the first movie you made?
It was this short film criticizing the lack of, like, ¿cómo se dice? Like, lack of infrastructure in Tijuana. Mm. Like, the roads were full of holes. So the idea of the short film was, like, I had a Range Rover that I was from, like, 1982. And we will go, like, really fast on top of, like, the holes, making points across the city. So it was just, like, a I don't know how you say it, but like a way to complain about how the government was like doing everything in that subject of like roads and stuff.
So because of your rebellion, do you think all your movies are a tool to call things out or to improve the things around you? You said you have a very rebellious nature to make things better around you.
I feel like later I started shifting a little bit, and it was more about like the lack of a relationship or love, and my focus shift a little. But I have done a lot of like NAT packages for the newscasts, and if I can show something that is not like fair, or then I will focus on like a social or a community issue. But in my personal work, it shifted a little bit. Yeah.
How would you describe your way of making documentaries? What makes them Paulina? Like, what's that stamp that makes them your own?
I feel like definitely doing like video essays, because I like to write a lot. So I write a lot of poetry, and then I make videos about the poetry that I write. And that has a lot to do with my main influences, which are Agnes Varda, Jonas Mekas, Chris Marker, that were more experimental with the documentary stuff. And I feel like the way I produce is similar to that. Like, I really, really admire them.
It's more poetic. How does it sounds like your way of making documentaries is more poetic than journalistic.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like it's a balance, because when I work for the news, if I do, because it's not my job where I work at, it's not making, I don't make news content, but sometimes I do. And when I do, it's very different from my personal work, which is like more poetic documentary video essay style. And by poetic, I mean, it's like writing something and then having images that will go with the voiceover. And sometimes I have people that translate those voiceovers to like a different language, to like German or Italian. And then I have a video that has like three different languages.
So it sounds like it's like, because a lot of documentaries are a picture of, you're trying to convey information about reality. It sounds like yours are more emotional.
Yeah. And I feel that it's a little bit more open, so that you can watch it and feel whatever you want to feel.
Cool. How did you go from that to getting into TV production?
Well, the reality is that I was living in Tijuana and I wanted a job in San Diego. And of course, I wanted to move to LA. Like, my whole life I've been wanting to have a job in LA. But for now, it was like that was my first option. So I wanted to have a paycheck, and that meant having a job in television, right? So I started in Univision, working as a creative producer, and then I moved to Telemundo NBC, which is a duopoly, doing the same. And then I started getting more involved with the news department. So for me, that was really cool, because I really loved documentary production, and that was very similar. Like, I'm working for television, but I'm doing something that I'm actually interested in.
Do you get to follow stories that you actually like, or do you get assigned stories?
It was like stories that were assigned to me most of the time, because that was not my main role. So it will be like, hey, Paulina, if you want to do this project, okay. But I feel like, you know, even if you have the camera and you edit, you can transform it a little bit. So, yeah, I feel like at the end they looked more like documentaries than journalistic pieces for a television station.
Has working in TV changed the way you make documentaries, your personal ones?
No, I feel it's been the other way around. Like, I've been applying what I know and what I think it's good to TV production.
Just adding some more
like cinematography
to them,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Just dry.
And even now that I have better equipment in Colorado in terms of camera and lighting equipment, everything looks more cinematic. And that's what I like, that we are starting to be different from the other television stations, because the quality is just so different. And it's
because you're bringing more art.
Yeah, it's the way you frame things, how you tell the story. Even if it's a news promo that is 30 seconds, it can be really well shot. Like, and I feel like sometimes people that work in television for a long time are just used to doing things really fast, and I take care of every detail. Mm. Even to my creative producers, I tell them, like, this is the boot camp of creativity. Like, we're not doing television, we're doing production that has high quality. Mm. Because I'm interested that our Hispanic viewers have quality in their, you know, in the things that they watch in our channel.
Mm-hmm. How has that transition been? Because Tijuana is a very dynamic place. There's a lot of drama here. Mm-hmm. Colorado seems like it's a lot more stable.
Drama because of the border?
Yeah, I mean, yes, but yeah, and just like Tijuana in general is like a magnet for conflict in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of drama here.
Yeah,
Colorado. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like it's like a lot more quiet. So how has that been in terms of like keeping you excited and engaged?
I think the struggle is different because Hispanics there don't have a border, like immediate border. We have a lot of people living there from Chihuahua. But like, you know, like finding your roots in a Midwest state, it's really hard sometimes. So like when I find Hispanics that are, you know, doing things that they are passionate about or that they are, I don't know, going through any kind of struggle, like sometimes just the thing of being an immigrant, I think the struggle is different and the stories change, but they are still meaningful and there can be drama, right? But like, I feel like nowadays with the actual or the current political situation, I feel like more than making people afraid is like giving them tools or giving them hope through the stuff that we cover and information, right? So that's our main focus.
That's great. That sounds like you're the perfect person for the job. I mean, there's enough people adding fear to the world through the media.
I know.
I wish more people thought like that.
Have you had that situation in which you're like, you know, that just we're spinning it the wrong way? It just sounds like we're trying to make people afraid. Have you pushed back and said, you know what?
No. Well, the news director, I have a really good relationship with her and they get a lot of feedback on how they should produce, but we support each other. And even when we make a promo, it's for people to tune in and know what they can learn from their immigration status or whatever they need. So it's just like a constant open conversation with our team. It's not that I decide something. It's like we have this idea and we pursue it. Mm. And we work together to achieve it.
Great.
And that's why we are successful, because we work as a team. Like, I am the news department, they are the creative department. It's like we are tangled?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Intertwined.
Intertwined.
I'm going to shift a little bit. You are a 35-time Emmy nominee and 17-time winner.
Yeah.
How does that feel to hear that? That's some big numbers.
It feels crazy because it just, time flew and I don't know how everything happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. I'm just very passionate about what I do. And when you work like that, and I learned that when we were doing a short documentary about this really famous ice cream maker in Otay Mesa. And he said, you have to do your job like you're playing. And then you're not gonna feel like you're working. And I never forgot that. So I always work and I always feel that I'm playing. Obviously, sometimes I feel stressed and sometimes I don't want to go to work or whatever, like everyone else, but I feel passionate in general. Mm-hmm. So when I win the awards, it's just like, hey, thank you. It's like a validation.
I'm playing really good.
Yeah.
Which out of all the Emmy nominations and wins, which of them was the most significant?
Definitely the first one, just because that was the hardest. Because the first time I tried, I didn't get it, and I tried like twice. But the most important has been, to be honest, one about the story about the Armadillos Búsqueda y Rescate, which is like a group that rescue people in the border of Tijuana, California, all of that, you know.
What do you mean they rescue them?
they rescue them, like their family members will call and say like, hey, this is the last time this person called. He was here. He's wearing this, you know, kind of whatever clothes. And then this group will go and organize and go and look for the missing people in the desert.
So people that have that tried to cross the border,
exactly,
and like they haven't heard from them. Like, did he get to the U.S.?
Did he not?
Okay.
Exactly. So that was, but I did propose one category, which is called which was called border issues, and so because I was part of the board for a couple of years, and I won an award in that category, which was meaningful because I was like, oh, I proposed this for everyone, for all my colleagues, and then I won. And now it doesn't exist anymore, but which I think it should, but I don't know.
It's the perfect time for it.
I know. I don't make the rules.
Okay, estamos grabando.
I want to hear more about the process of Armadillos because it's something like Armadillos. It's definitely not shooting in a studio. You really have to put yourself, in potential real danger. Like, what was that process like?
It was a cathartic moment in my life because that was the first time that I actually went out to shoot and I had to carry all of my equipment, my food, my water, because I didn't want to interfere with this group's job, which was they were looking for a young man. So we walked for like 11 hours in the desert. It was just life-changing, to be honest. And then I decided to take my car and I had the sentry in that car and I saw the border patrol because I got there. It was in Jacumba, which is like not far away from Tecate, right? And I got there first and then I saw the border patrol basically like going in where I was and like looping. They didn't say anything and left. And I was like, oh, this was really uncomfortable, but I don't know. Like, I'm not doing anything that I shouldn't. And of course, like 2 days after shooting the first package, my sentry got revoked and I had to like cross the border again, like when I was in college, by feet, taking the trolley, grabbing my car, going to work for like 5 months. And I was like fighting them, like, come on, like I was doing this. I had the letter from the news director, the reason, the package, like the, you know, the project, like I was working. And I understand that I looked suspicious, right? Like a Mini Cooper in the middle of nowhere with sentry. But
how do they track you? They're just from license plates?
I think so, yeah. It was very immediate. I was, 2 days after being there, I didn't have a sentry anymore for like 5 months. And then eventually they gave it back.
They did give it back.
Yeah, because I had all the reasons that I was working. And I understand that, you know, that they don't have to give it back, but like they did. So that's
good. Oh, that's the thing. We can talk all the shit we want, but it's good that they gave it back.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Okay, you did it, but you had to put up a good fight.
Yeah. I had all the documentation and the video, and so, but it was interesting, even that process. And I always felt that it was totally worth it. It was totally worth it because I feel like living in the border and not really knowing how people are trying to, you know, to have a better life by crossing it and living in the States. Mm-hmm. And then being there for like a couple of hours and then being able to go back home and take a shower and water and eat. I was like, wait, this humbles you. Mm-hmm. Now, every time I cross the border by car, I know that, you know, it's really hard. And mm-hmm. and the privilege that it is to be inside a car with AC, with your music, complaining about how long the line is. Come on.
Yeah, I think about that a lot.
Yeah, you're
it's
not
so
walking.
It's so easy to complain, and like, but you realize, like, whoa, I can actually cross, and as soon as I cross, I can go get a burrito, or I can go get a Coke.
Totally.
You know, it's like it's fine. It's not that big of a deal.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Just a little time.
Yeah, for sure.
We're about to listen to a clip from Armadillos, Búsqueda y Rescate.
Si no venimos nosotros, como grupos.
If we don't come as a group, the deaths occurring in the desert will continue to go overlooked and unpunished, which is truly disheartening. We have left our entire lives in our home countries. We leave it all behind. Only to meet the same fate as a brother is heartbreaking.
Nosotros venimos el día de hoy.
Today we visited the place where he lost his life.
Al lugar donde quedó nuestro hermano, a dejar una cruz.
To leave a cross and offer our prayers.
A rezarle. Esta es la realidad.
This is the harsh truth, the somber reality, that young people are risking their lives in pursuit of the so-called American dream, which for me is not a dream at all.
That was a clip from Armadillo's Búsqueda y Rescate. Can you tell me a few more stories about the process of Armadillo's and some of the people you met during that process?
Mm-hmm. So this group of men and women were very courageous because they were doing this like without any sort of money or pay or anything. They were just like really wanted to look. They wanted to look for the people in the desert. But I don't know. I think it was a lesson of unity and working in as a team, and also achieving things. Like, for example, they didn't find the body when we went to the desert the first time, but the second time they went and I couldn't go, they found this young man. He was dead. And then the third time I went with them, and it was like, we just want to go there again to make sure that his body is not there anymore. And making sure of that was walking like 12 hours steep in the desert. And it was like 120 degrees. It was like really hot just to make sure and to put a cross. So you like I was able to see how serious they were about just helping the families feel better about losing their, you know, their loved ones. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, and it's crazy because two things that I learned from that experience was that the only smell that you find in the desert is just the smell of death, which is dead animals or dead people. And this group of persons were able to like use their nose to follow where the bodies were. So it's just very extreme. And everything is trying to attack you, like the plants, the animals. It's like nothing there is soft, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was like, it was a nice, it was a good experience. And it was, yeah, to learn about contrast and of the environment. Like we live so close to the beach and then this extreme reality, just 2 hours inland. Mm. Yeah, and the same with other stories, like here in Tijuana with the pollution of the river, that the people that live in the river live a very different story from all of us who are just here in the city. And the other day we were walking and
we all share the same air and the same...
Totally, yeah. But it's a totally different life. And like then you see how the hospital is so close and it's so far away from them, you know, because they cannot go and access healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so those kind of contrasts that are like key of the border, no? Okay.
It sounds like the Armadillo's process really just tested you as a filmmaker, as an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, plus I was going through like a very challenging era in my life, so I felt that I wanted to be part of like something that was, you know, when you are not feeling super well with your life, but then you experience this kind of stories and you're like, wait, you know, mm-hmm. like this is harder than what I'm going through, and I don't know, it gives you perspective. Mm-hmm. So I feel that if we're artists, it's nice to have those perspectives and then center yourself again and start anew, no, in a way.
So that process really helped you.
Yeah, I think
beyond
so.
Beyond the actual documentary, just yeah. refocused you and your life. And
I think so. Yes.
I think one of my favorite parts of your resume is you created a whole new category for the Emmys mm-hmm. called Border Stories. Mm-hmm. How
border issues?
Borders. That's what it was called. Border Issues.
Border Issues. It was weird. Is it? Yeah, I think so.
You created a border new category something. Around border-related stories. How was that process to create a new category for the Emmys.
So these were the regional Emmys. So the Emmys that we get here in California are the Pacific Southwest. And then you get the primetime Emmys, which is like bigger markets, like, you know, like nationwide stuff. But so the first thing I had to do was be a board of governor. And I decided to do that because I didn't feel represented by the board. And this happens even in Colorado, right? Like it's just mostly Caucasian instead of Hispanics trying to. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing. And when I was there, I was thinking like, well, a lot of my peers are creating stories about the border that have nothing to do with political issues or government stuff. It's just like very specific. Mm-hmm. And I saw that Texas had like Texas Heritage or something like that. And I was like, how is this possible that we don't have something specific for the border if they are having
it? Yeah, if Texas has heritage.
Exacto. Why can't we have border issues, right? Separate, because it's very, it's a niche, no sé. Mm-hmm. And so I proposed that for a couple of months, and it was a process of like 5 months because I was not like the executive board, part of the executive board. I was just part of the board, but they were able to present it to the to like a higher level of people that are more in charge of the national Emmys. And they make all of these smaller decisions like, oh, OK, we can do that or no, we cannot do that. So it was approved. And that's how we include that in the as part of the categories for the Emmys in the Pacific Southwest chapter. But I asked and like a year or 2 years ago, they removed it, which I think it was not the best idea because not because I proposed it, but because I honestly believe that we need that category here.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why it was removed?
I don't know. Sometimes it happens when not a lot of people are submitting. Mm-hmm. And if there are not enough stories, it's just like a waste of money in a way. So they think, well, we're going to remove this and they can go back to politics or government issues or whatever. So I think that's what happened.
Mm. Are you gonna fight to get it back?
I don't think so because I'm not here anymore. But we can ask people to fight for it.
Julio. Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about Avenida Bugambilia?
Yeah. So Avenida Bugambilia was my first documentary. It was a 60-minute documentary, so barely a long. Long one. But yeah, it was like a very personal process and it took a couple of years, maybe like 2 years to get made because I was experimenting with like the letters and the voiceovers and the poetic visual stuff that I spoke before. And then I decided to interview my grandma and her sister and it took like a more complete form and I created the documentary like mixing the interviews with the letters. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's nice to watch it, but it's not easy because it's very, I don't know, it's like a internal journey of love and destruction and depression.
Is it hard to go back and watch it for you or is it?
Not for me. Maybe because if it's hard is because I'm too critical maybe. Of things that I could have done better.
It was your first one.
Yeah, it was the first one. And it has been the only one because I shifted so much. And I've been doing like smaller pieces, like video poems and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But for me, it doesn't have to be long to be meaningful. Like I feel like things that are short are meaningful too. Mm-hmm. So.
I'm short.
You're not.
I'm not tall.
But I'm
meaningful.
Yeah.
Now we're going to listen to a clip from Avenida Bugambilia.
I believe in love, but I have lost a bit of hope. They say it's the last thing to die. I don't know. These days, I have also found myself alone, enjoying my own company, singing to myself, touching myself, liking myself. And then I think to myself, someone is going to be very lucky the day he finds me. The day he finds me in the middle of this journey, sitting in a cantina, breathing in the air at the beach, while having a coffee, reading a book in a park, or at a party in a museum, or spending the afternoon by the sea.
That was a clip from Paulina's first film, Avenida Bugambilia. What inspired you? How did that come together for it to be your first documentary? I'm sure it was.
So I created the visuals for the letters first, and I had like, which in the documentary are chapters. So the documentary is like a book. It has an epilogo. How do you say that in English?
Epilogue.
Epilogue, chapters, and a prologue. And so every chapter is a letter. And in the middle of those chapters, I have the interviews with my grandma and her sister, which were the ones that my grandma was sending the letter. Okay, so my grandma got divorced in the 50s.
Oh, it was your grandma.
Yeah.
I just thought it was some random lady.
No.
That makes a lot more sense.
So my grandma got...
I didn't say that before.
Yeah, you're right. No, she got divorced in the 50s and she decided to travel to Europe after that because, you know, it wasn't very usual that happened in mm-hmm. that time. So when she was there going through all these emotions, depression and internal processes, she started writing letters to her sister in Tecate. So the documentary is about a selection of 10 letters. And in the middle of those, of a voiceover reading the letters and showing visuals that go with that, is the interviews of them telling how was that moment in time for them as sisters, like to live, you know, the separation and missing one sister and being sad that she was going through, you know, all of that and stuff like that. Mm. So it's kind of personal. I feel like people can relate. Because we go through that, like mm-hmm. we all go through heartache at some point in our lives. But yeah, it's just like a long, deep.
Did your grandma get to see the film?
No, she didn't. Her sister did.
The one that was receiving the letters?
Yeah.
How did your family take the movie?
I think they feel grateful that it exists because I had a really good connection with my grandma and she passed away and I literally forced her to be on camera. Like I didn't ask permission. I was like, I'm going to put the camera here while you're drinking your coffee. And I was just shooting and every time.
She had no idea what was going on.
She knew that I was shooting because I told her, but she didn't know that I was going to use that for like some, like, you know, people to look. You know, and now that it lives in YouTube or Vimeo or whatever. So, you know, people used to be more private. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that would have been maybe too much for her. I think she would have accepted the project at the end, but she never watched it.
She probably never expected her very private letters to her sisters to be
true.
Public.
Yeah, but it helps. It helps the generations
yeah.
come.
Did you have to ask anyone, like her permission or your mom or anyone for...
I never asked for permission.
Perdón.
Yeah, siempre. It's like now that I'm in Colorado, so we have Red Rocks there and we were doing a promo and I knew that I needed permission, but I thought that it was going to be complicated and I just went and I shot. And then they... You know, people got there like, what are you doing? And they gave me permission there. So I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, next time.
Viva Mexico.
Pues sí, güey.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the Sin Spoiler podcast?
Sin Spoiler is a project that I have on the side just because I'm a film fanatic. And I spent like 80% of my time at the movies in Colorado. So I thought that it would be a good idea to just have like a space for my reviews in Spanish about these weird movies that I was watching that I liked. So yeah,
It's you by yourself talking about the movie.
It's like it's like really short. I try to keep it like under 5 minutes, 6 minutes at the most, so that people and it's in spoilers, like no spoilers, so that people can listen to it. And like, okay, I want to watch it, or I don't think I'll watch it.
Mm. How has the response been to that?
Honestly, right now I'm going through a hard phase just because, you know, the first months of the year, we don't have good movies. Mm. So
that's a thing? Oh, I guess it's like post-award season or whatever?
Yeah, exacto, exacto. From like February to August, it's trash mostly. Mm. So, and it's sad because, you know, I would say we see everything that goes on in Cannes, and then we have to wait months and months to get those movies in the movie theater. Mm. So at the moment, I'm taking a pause because I don't have enough movies to...
Cheerio.
Yeah. Pero I started doing that just to keep myself sane, to be honest, because I just want to do films and be in the film world, and television is just so different, which I enjoy, but it's just a different world.
Have you thought about going into fiction filmmaking, not documentary?
See, and that has been how do you say, like when something is tormenting you, it's tormenting me because I'm like, okay, I should write a script, but at the same time, it's just hard. Like I don't see it. So what I started doing right now is just writing a short story. And I started this like two weeks ago because I had everything in my head. I'm just like, I'm just going to start writing. And then if I finish, I can make that into a script and then I see what I do. But I feel like step by step, because if I just think about a script for a feature film, way, it feels like a lot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like I don't...
One step at a time.
Sí, exacto.
No más necesitas like momentum, no?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I prefer to write five good pieces of paper than like trying to write something that it's just chaotic in my brain, at least.
What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned in storytelling or filmmaking throughout the last almost 20 years now that you've been making films?
I feel like you definitely have to feel connected to what you're doing. Otherwise, it loses the meaning. I don't think I have a specific answer for that. I feel like throughout the years I've been perfecting the way I do things, and I'm better at like the production part of it. And for me, it comes very naturally, like just talking to people and finding stories. Like I can talk to anyone and find a story in that person. And I feel like that's what I do now. Like it's just very intuitive. And maybe that's what has happened through the years, that because I've learned how to listen, now I find stories quickly. And it's very easy for me to find the value. And if I can do it, let's say right now we are going to start working on Hispanic heritage news packages in promotions and stuff like that. And I already found a kid that plays a saxophone from Venezuela in this restaurant, and he's like 13. Yeah, so like that, I feel like it's not that I have like a, ¿cómo dijiste? Like un consejo.
No, I that was my next question. Just lessons you've learned for yourself.
The only advice I always give is like, start with whatever you have. You don't need the iPad or this great camera or whatever. Just do it in any way that you can. Because starting, I know it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. And like I was saying before, like if it feels overwhelming, then reduce it and start with like one piece of paper. Don't try to write 20. Like it's better to start and make it better later than just keep it in your head, you know? So that will be the first thing and like the only thing. If you really want to do it with whatever you have.
Yeah, I think that applies to any art form. So many times I've been slowed down by the overwhelm, and it's just like, yeah, just start, just one little thing.
Just one thing. Mm-hmm. Just 1 minute. If you want to do a podcast, just do 1 minute.
Have you, this is another question, but something that I think about the more that I'm like in the world of storytelling is how the stories we tell, even to ourselves, like shape reality. Mm-hmm. How do you think about that? Like, has being involved in storytelling changed the way that you relate to your own life?
Yeah. And I feel like I see my life through a different lens. And it's a lens that it keeps evolving because you're aware of what you're going through. Mm. You do not live in automatic. O sea, you're aware of the people you meet, of the stories you find, of how even like the bird that just flew by is like, oh, that looks nice, maybe. And then you start thinking more. maybe this will go nice with the this and da-da-da. So
everything's a story.
Exacto. Mm-hmm. Es que everything can be a story. Or just make your life more poetic, no? And I feel like that's another art I once read that is not taken serious, like the art of just looking. Mm-hmm. And even like the art of listening. Like people just want to talk all the time.
Thank you so much, Paulina, for your time and your words and all the great stories you've told over the years. I'm excited to see what stories come next.
Thank you for having me, and thank you everyone for listening. Check out Sin Spoilers podcast in Spotify.
And your future movie that has only begun to be written.
Exactly.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their healthcare to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Paulina's story highlights the possibilities for women aiming to make an impact in the TV and film industry, even if the path isn't an easy one. Like Marla, Marintia, and Nicolasa, from part one of this special, Paulina encountered challenges inherent to being a woman and filmmaker from Tijuana. But nonetheless, they are all making significant strides in an industry where women still direct only a small percentage of films in Hollywood and Mexico, as evidenced by stagnant statistics in 2024. Despite these challenges, these talented filmmakers have successfully established their unique voices and stories in a male-dominated field. And in Paulina's case, despite being targeted by the Department of Homeland Security, their determination stands as a testament to the power of self-belief and pursuing a worthy cause. When you have purpose, there's no need to feel afraid or hold back. Instead, let your resilience shine. That's the message I wanted to share with you with these two episodes. What I felt over the last 30 years of my life, both as a fronteriza and as a woman in the arts. These successful women are proving that impactful filmmaking can transcend geographical and gender boundaries, blazing the trail for future generations of girls who dream of making it big on the big screen. This episode of Port of Entry was written and produced by Julio Cesar Ortiz Franco.
Adrian Villalobos is technical producer and sound designer. This episode was edited by Julio Cesar Ortiz Franco.
Lisa Jane Morissette is director of audio programming and operations.
This program is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. Soy Alan Ilienthal.
Y yo soy Natalie González.
Nos vemos pronto.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Art Power at UC San Diego, presenting Afrobeat Collective Coco Roco, touring their new album Tough Times Never Last on August 12th at the Epstein Family Amphitheater. Tickets at artpower.ucsd.edu.